get ready for the unspeakable, the unworkable, and the unexperienceable. Get ready for the unbodied science fiction radio theater. This month's episode is entitled 6040 Part 1 and was written by Jeff Sink.
The woman adjusted the black locks of hair cascading over her forehead one more time. It was unnecessary. She'd already styled her hair according to her employer's exacting standards earlier. But it kept her busy. She was trying anything to get her mind off the work carpool and the fact that it was 10 minutes late. Her endeavor wasn't entirely foolproof. Every few seconds, a stray thought rose to her attention. The image of the small booklet she had been given at work, wherein the rules of employment were contained. The list of expectations, it was called, and comfortably residing on the second line was this precept. An employee of the state shall not be more than 5 minutes tardy to his or her duties, otherwise termination of said employee shall occur. She had always been employed, as had her entire family, and the idea of being unemployed had never occurred to her before. They weren't that type of people, she was taught. Now that threat hung over her, still in the periphery of her mind, but growing. As someone with a terminated status on her employment record, she would never see another position again. Her debt would grow so bloated and unchecked, the state would confiscate her possessions to pay it off. She'd have to go to the settlement camps, becoming a 60, one of roughly 60% of the population in the country that didn't have work. She would disappear from the coveted world of the employed, to be replaced there by the story of her demise told at parties by former co-workers. She blinked hard to force the thoughts away and repositioned a glossy ebony curl. Outside, a horn squealed. The blue vehicle was waiting at the end of her freshly shoveled walk as usual, with chunks of crusty snow still laying on the roof. The negligence a sign the driver had been in a hurry this morning. She briefly considered flying into a rage as she neared the vehicle, but when she saw the drawn, sickly face of her co-worker at the wheel, she lost her momentum. "I know I'm late," he said hastily, leaning out the window. His breath curled up into the frigid air. "You know you're late. I know you're late. Damn, I guess there's nothing for us to talk about now." She popped open the car door and fell into the seat. The driver tore away from the curb. The vehicle raced past the other residences. Each home appeared to be different from the next, until you drove through the entire gated neighborhood and noticed the architectural pattern repeating. The houses appeared sullen, surrounded by dead, dusty grass and cloaked in fog. "I slept in," the driver explained, "because I was up late. I had to pick up my brother from his job at midnight, but he never showed." "Did he stiff you for another ride?" "No, he never came home. When I left this morning, he still hadn't checked in with the house log." The woman looked down at her painted nails lying over her sandy-colored coat. Registering with a house log each day was a requirement for everyone living in employee housing. This didn't mean the employee had to log in at his own home only. He could register at a friend's or a lover's just as long as he was in the system. But failing to appear on any log was usually an indication that something bad had happened. The woman had heard of people disappearing every so often. Usually it was due to an overpowering drug habit that inevitably led to termination and a life and death on the streets. But her coworker had always boasted of his brother's industriousness and how being employed had made the rest of their family, still unemployed in the settlement camps, so proud. Surely he wouldn't do anything to lose his job and dishonor his family. But maybe his brother was hiding something, she thought. Someone in the back seat tugged roughly at the woman's shoulder. "You know what I bet it was?" the assailant asked. It was an older woman who'd been employed longer than the others. "I bet his brother took his own life." "That's ridiculous," the driver said under his breath. "But this is exactly how it happens. A boy from the settlement camps finally gets a job and he can't handle all the responsibility. Finally, it just gets to him and he kills himself. I heard about it on the radio." The driver accelerated. He took a bend in the frost-coated road quickly, and the car lost traction, swinging roughly in a jagged arc. It slid a few yards before he was able to regain control. He slowed down. "No more prognosticating," the woman announced. "We shouldn't consider the most horrendous things first. I, for one, would rather listen to the radio speak." She pressed a button in the center console, and the sound of a man's voice entered the vehicle.
"Leaving the Central Monetary Fund with a more optimistic numbers than previously expected. M. Yamanuro expects this will cause a growth in our economy of 1 to 1.5.
"That could mean more jobs," a man in the back seat said. He was originally from the settlement camps, like the driver. The radio continued.
"Today, peace talks resume with the AFO Authority in the Demilitarized Zone. This series of talks, which began 2 days ago, marked the first such discussion of peace in 10 years.
The woman thought back to the last time the government had tried to establish peace with what most people referred to as the adversary. Several incendiary devices had detonated in the subway, shredding the trains and everyone inside. Following this incident, the government had abandoned the talks, choosing instead to ratchet up defense within the country. That was when the biometric authentication devices were introduced to every vehicle, residence, and public building for the purposes of tracking any potential terrorists. In this round of talks, nothing had yet happened, but the woman knew there was still time.
"Government reports indicate that the AFO wishes to make serious agreements and demonstrate its goodwill to our people."
"If they want to demonstrate goodwill," the older woman said, "they should start by returning our weather back to normal. For almost a year, they've been manipulating our climate systems to try to kill everything in this country. I'm tired of the cold."
"Well, they wouldn't do that unless we gave them something big, like returning Dr. Adolphson to them," the man in the back replied. "But that's never going to happen." "Well, somebody's going to have to back up their words with actions sooner or later," the woman said. The vehicle descended slowly into a set of concrete arches. They had entered the tunnel. It was the sole means of entering Central City, where the government, and hence most employment, was located. Access to this part of the country was restricted to employed persons only, and barricading devices were in place as a safeguard against invasion. Nothing so dire had ever occurred since the founding of the country, however, and the massive doors remained retracted behind the entrance, rusting. Inside the tunnel, the roadway ran between the raised tracks of the trolley and the canal bringing water into Central City. In the distance, perhaps a quarter of a mile ahead, the woman spotted a line of vehicles. They did not appear to be moving. There was no reason to stop in the tunnel, and there had never been enough traffic to cause congestion, so their presence was perplexing. They came upon the roadblock and slowed to a stop.
"Not another problem," the driver said.
The vehicles rested within the confines of each lane, as if they had simply stopped on their way through the tunnel. The woman pivoted her head left and right, searching for the vehicle's inhabitants, but no one was inside.
"What is this mess?" the older woman asked.
Maybe some maintenance work?" the man beside her offered.
"They wouldn't be doing work right now," she responded. "Besides, we would have been informed of it."
"Whatever it is, it's going to make us late," the driver said. He exhaled deeply and turned off the vehicle.
"Not me," the older woman said. "I don't start my shift until 10. I'll be fine."
"Oh, what a relief," the driver said under his breath. The woman shifted in her seat again, trying to see past the cars.
"I'm going to go see what's wrong," she said.
The older woman laughed.
"What are you going to do? I'm sure it's not something you could solve."
The woman turned to regard her.
"Well, either I go out and investigate, or I stay in here and continue to enjoy your company. I've made up my mind."
She left the car. Upon stepping onto the road, the woman felt disoriented. She had never walked in the tunnel before. Her passage through it had always been inside the car. But now, freed from that restriction, she perceived how different everything was here. The road was not coated in glistening ice like the rest of the country, but was rather dull and dry. The air was humid. No doubt the canal was the reason. She approached it. The water there jostled against the edge of the canal, and memories of lake visits exploded into the woman's mind. She recalled the feeling of water tickling her legs as it jumped around her, like it had done when she had waded along the beach as a kid. Goosebumps formed on her arms. The memory did not feel right to her. It was familiar, and yet it felt as if she should not have been able to remember it, like it had been stolen from someone else. "What are you doing?" the driver called from his window. The woman turned then to the abandoned cars. Approaching one, she pressed her hand against the window, feeling the cold enter her palm. There was no one inside. In front of these cars sat another row of vehicles, and as she weaved her way through, she found yet another row of vehicles still ahead, and another. She walked briskly through the traffic jam, glancing around but finding no one. The woman was about 100 yards from where she'd left the others when she discovered the end of the pack of cars. She carefully inspected each vehicle here, but no obvious cause for the roadblock jumped out to her. Because her fingerprint was not authorized on any of these vehicles' doors, the woman could not enter and peruse any more closely. Inside one of the cars, she spotted an electronic tablet. In another, a man's coat lay rumpled in the driver's seat. Down the road, there came a grinding sound, as if some rough object were being dragged. The woman walked toward the noise, moving forward slowly. She stumbled and looked down. The road was damaged here. A long gash had been dug into the asphalt. It ended at the edge of the canal, where the safety fence running along the road had been torn away. Several mangled pieces of the fence lay about the road, and as the woman came to the canal, she could see a few more pieces bobbing in the water. She saw something else in the water as well. It was dark and large. Instinctively, she looked up, expecting some object on the ceiling to be causing a shadow, but there was nothing. Back in the water, the dark object moved. It grew in size until it erupted from the water, rising almost high enough to graze the ceiling. The woman didn't know what it was, at first, her mind unable to accept what she saw. Its bruise-colored skin was stretched tightly over muscles and angular bones. The thorny spine, beginning at its hindquarters and moving up to the neck, seemed ready to burst from the flesh. It moved, and the jagged scales around its joints ground together. Its four thick legs positioned the beast onto the roadway, dragging its club-like tail behind it. The woman didn't move as the beast's long, sloping head turned on its muscular neck in her direction. The eyes, round, muddy-colored, and gelatinous, pivoted around in multiple directions. Its jaw opened, and out of a bed of serrated teeth, a tongue shot out, teasing the air before returning to the mouth. Weight shifted from limb to limb as the beast moved toward the woman, slowly, with head bent down. The woman tore away and began to run. She slipped quickly through the crowd of vehicles, knocking into a side-view mirror every few paces. Fear stabbed at her, but she looked back once to see the monster still, with mouth agape, tongue whipping through the air. When she returned to her co-workers, she found several new vehicles parked around them, the passengers eyeing her intently. She opened the car door. "Well, what's the problem?" the older woman asked. "There's something on the road," the woman answered, her hand struggling to put her seatbelt on. "Like a barricade?" the driver asked. "No, like a thing, a living thing." The woman's voice lowered. "It looked like a lizard." "What in the hell are you talking about?" the older woman barked. "A lizard? Why would a lizard be blocking traffic?" "Because it's enormous," the woman shouted. "It's twice as big as his car, at least." "That's not possible," the driver said. "Whatever it is, I'm sure I can move it." The woman grabbed his arm. "We need to leave," she said. "I don't understand what's going on here, but I don't think it's something we want to get involved in. We have to go." "But how else will we get to work?" the man in the back asked. "I bet you're exaggerating. Let's go check it out." He opened his door. "Don't do that," the woman warned. "Just stay here. Maybe we can contact the authorities." He left. The driver opened his door. "I'm sure if we contacted our employment, they would send someone out," she said. The driver left. The woman's seat shook as a flabby arm gripped the headrest. The older woman struggled to get onto her feet.
You can rest assured that when this is all over, I'll make sure you never work again, the older woman snapped, stepping out of the car herself. This is a waste of my time. She slammed the door.
The woman watched her, and half a dozen people from the other cars, walk slowly down the tunnel. She slid over into the driver's seat and pressed her finger into the ignition button, but the car failed to respond. She turned on the radio, which continued to babble its numbers and statistics. Outside, a metallic screech rocketed throughout the tunnel. The woman sat back, eyes closed, taking several deep breaths and rubbing the bridge of her nose with her index fingers. Then, gathering her things, she opened the door and ran. Alex heard of its arrival not by a warning spread over the PA system of the department store he worked in, but by a scream. It came from someone in the houseware section, roughly two gleaming marble aisles away from him, and it was accompanied by a cacophony of shattering glass, metal bowls resounding as they struck the floor, and the sound of something heavy and sharp dragging. There was more scraping and wood groaning as he saw a tiered display of microwaves just one aisle away collapse under the blow of a thick, serrated claw. The beast raised its head, tongue thrashing the air. Alex plunged down into the cavity of his desk. The beast's appearance was not entirely unexpected for Alex. One morning at breakfast, while the radio gave out its cheerful daily insistences that all was well, his sister had told his family about the thing. She spoke softly, and there was little discussion. They all knew that the government had released no statement about the monster's appearance, and if the government didn't acknowledge it, it didn't exist. It was only a rumor to them. Now, Alex listened as the thing rampaged through the store. There was a crash and a thousand tiny metallic shrieks as the display for flatware was knocked over, knives, spoons, and forks bouncing on the floor once or twice before settling. Laundry machines let out their own high-pitched whine as the beast pushed through them. It was nearing Alex's desk. His heart rattled inside his chest, agitating his thoughts. His mouth went dry. Alex pulled out his mobile and dialed his supervisor, and was immediately connected with her answering machine. He hung up. He could call his parents, but a glance at the clock told him they wouldn't answer. They would never accept a call during work hours, for fear of being terminated. A metal rack crashed to the floor close to his desk. He thought of anyone else he might contact, but came up empty. His sister would be at work as well, and his friends were unemployed and didn't have mobiles. He suddenly remembered the elevator, standing idle not more than 20 feet away. He could run to it, he thought, and ride down to the first floor. There was an exit on that level. But doubt invaded his thoughts. What if the beast was standing close to the desk, mouth open, ready to shred him to pieces? And the elevator could be slow, too slow to arrive before the beast met up with him. He didn't want to die waiting for an elevator. He grumbled, searching for another solution. He could think of nothing else. He attempted to stand, but found himself stuck in place. He rocked back and forth, but was unable to free himself. His heart thrashed inside him. Just do it, just do it, just do it, just do it, just do it. He sprang up to a standing position, and fear struck him like pins all over his face. He returned to a crouch. Stupid, he muttered to himself. Don't stand, stay down low. With body curved and legs bent, he pushed open the swinging door of his desk and whipped around the corner, slamming into a pile of boxes. He fell on his side, one box landing between his legs and another at the very edge of his arm, nipping at his fingers. Terror electrified his body, and he rolled onto his feet and began to run for the elevator. He saw the beast amidst several concentric rings of destroyed merchandise not too far from him. The young man swiped his hand over the touchscreen to call the elevator. His eyes were fixed on the beast. It took a few steps forward in the seconds it took for the elevator to arrive. Alex jumped in and selected the first floor, prodding the screen several times until the door shut and the elevator began to lumber downward. With a shudder, the gray doors rolled away, and he stepped onto the first floor, with row upon row of apparel arranged under the bright, clean lighting. Each shirt hung uniformly one amongst the next on the racks. Pants, crisp and pressed, were stacked on circular displays. Faceless white mannequins in raincoats perched on a ledge above a pyramid of shoeboxes. The scene puzzled Alex. Who are all these things for? He thought. Most of the country can't afford to buy anything at this department store, yet the employees were always instructed to keep the displays fully stocked. They were producing for no one. Another thought struck him. Why hadn't he considered any of this before? He continued to ruminate as he crossed down the main aisle to the exit. The department store, the radio had taught him, was a symbol of our ability to persevere through hardship and remain prosperous. It was an affront to the enemies of the country. His father had argued that working for the department store was his opportunity to be part of that hard-working spirit. But Alex knew he didn't work hard. More and more, he felt like he was an actor in an expansive play designed to satiate and comfort the public. He began wondering if there might be other plays in town, too, and other actors. As Alex passed the electronic ad board and opened the first set of doors to leave, a dark mass moved in from the left. He halted. The beast, ambulating in the vacant plaza in front of the store, turned and began charging toward him. Alex retreated back into the store. He was only a few feet away when from behind him the doors ruptured, glass screaming as it broke into glittering splinters. Alex dove between two rows of clothing. The marble floor quivered and cracked as the beast galloped further inside. Alex flew down the aisle to the end, where he found himself in an open space. He was exposed. The beast tore through a cashier's kiosk, sending debris skittering along the floor. Alex darted out, searching for a place to hide. There was a black steel door nestled into the wall, and upon seeing it, he sprinted for it. He shook the handle, but the door would not give way. He saw the bio-authorization pad and swiped his thumb over it, but still nothing happened. The beast forced the metal racks aside as it galloped toward Alex. He began slamming his body against the door, yelling incomprehensibly. Swiftly, the door flew open, and Alex fell into a large, shadowy room. The door closed, and a man pulled him back further into the dim space.
"Are you hurt?"
the man asked. "No, I don't think so," Alex answered. The man released him.
"You don't think so?" he said. "Are you hurt or not?"
"No," Alex said quickly. The man walked away. Alex's eyes adjusted to the dark, and he realized he was in one of the stockrooms. Several people were huddled behind the tall, cubic, three-dimensional printers anchored to the floor. Though they were a point of pride for the country, touted as being able to print almost any object using carbon captured in the atmosphere, Alex had never seen these 3D printers before. He approached the machine, his face illuminated by the idle white screen attached to one side. Inside the cube, the arm that sprayed out carbon according to the design specifications lay still.
"How many?"
a man beside him asked. He was middle-aged, wearing a dark suit, the cuffs of which were frayed.
"What? How many out there?"
he shifted closer to Alex.
"How many did you see?"
"Just one," he answered. "You think there are..." From outside the storeroom came a short rumble. The lights swayed on the ceiling. Alex turned from the middle-aged man to further inspect the printer. The other people began speaking to one another.
"Well, what will we do now?"
one man asked. He was sitting on the ground.
"Wait for it to leave,"
his companion answered.
"Well, how long will that take?"
"The hell if I know. It has to leave sometime, though, doesn't it?"
A teenage girl beside him began crying.
"My mother was going to pick me up today after my shift," she said. "If she gets here when that thing is still in the store..."
She erupted with body-shaking sobs.
"Oh, can't you contact her?"
the man beside her asked. She sat up quickly.
"Does it someone have a mobile I can borrow?"
Three people, including Alex, approached her.
"Thanks,"
she said, putting the device up to her ear.
"Can we call someone to help us?"
Alex asked.
"Like who?"
said the sitting man.
"Maybe the store manager."
"I'm the store manager,"
It was the man who'd let Alex into the room.
Well, then how about someone from the government? Maybe some kind of agency, or even just the general number?
The store manager snorted. You can call them if you want, but you won't get any help. You'll just spend an hour on the automated system, pressing buttons until it hangs up on you.
But how are we going to get out of here?
Alex asked. He approached the girl, who just ended her call.
You told your mom what was going on here?
Yes.
And is she going to do anything about it?
What would she do? The man sitting on the floor asked.
How could her mom handle that thing? She'd die,
added his companion.
Maybe, Alex said, she could get some people together and they could come here and...
Alex trailed off.
And they could all die together, the man on the floor said.
Well then, what are we supposed to do?
The store manager put his hand on Alex's shoulder.
You'd better try to get comfortable, he said.
An hour passed. Another. Another. Alex stood up from the box he'd been sitting on to stretch his legs. The teenage girl began crying again.
I just want this to stop, she said.
The store manager put his arm around her.
I want to know why this is happening.
The middle-aged man emerged from where he'd been sitting, away from the others.
I know why this is happening, he said. They sent it. They hate that we're so superior to them, so they unleashed this thing to try to scare us. Well, I'm not scared, are you?
He looked at the girl, eyes narrowing.
You're young. You don't understand yet. Let me tell you this. You may be afraid of what could happen today, but you shouldn't be. They won't win. Even if we should die, the state will continue. The state will prevail!
The girl turned away, burying her face in the store manager's chest.
Someone will come help us, the store manager said. We need to be patient.
The man on the floor and his companion both groaned and leaned in to speak more quietly together. Alex made his way to the bathroom. He stared at his reflection in the mirror as he splashed lukewarm water on his face. If he believed what the store manager said, would that make it all come true? He thought about the store, the employees painstakingly lying out merchandise every day for the customers that never came. He turned off the water and slowly rejoined the others to wait.
You've just heard 6040 Part 1, another story of the unbodied. Want more of the unbodied? Go to theunbodied.com. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.